Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here again with Charles Lincoln and Robert Lindsay. Just to give kind of a recap, so Charles, on our last show, talking about the film True Stories and the whole era of the 1980s. And on this show, we're going to be touching on a lot of similar themes, but I think would be a good theme would be, since we talked a lot about Texas and Dallas in that era, I think I'd like to devote this segment to Southern California.
Well, you know, Robert, I think that one of the most interesting things that we could talk about sort of in Southern California, if you, in relation to comparing it to True Stories, is a movie we talked about earlier this year on another one of your shows, and that is A Girl Walks Home at Night. Do you remember talking about that one?
Yeah.
A Girl Walks Home at Night seems relevant to me because we've been talking about multiculturalism and the transformation of the population. And A Girl Walks Home at Night is Buffy the Vampire Slayer meets the Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini in Southern California. So it's a 100% Farsi language movie filmed entirely in Southern California, entirely by Iranian actors.
Robert, you told me you actually were a substitute teacher in Beverly Hills, so you were kind of had some experience of that culture.
Well, I was only there for about a week.
When was that?
Oh, I don't know, 1989, maybe?
The Iranian invasion had definitely started by then. I remember 1989. What was it specifically like, and where else did you teach? You must have, if you taught in Beverly Hills, you must have taught in other places too. Where else?
I taught all over L.A. in Orange County.
Well, can you tell us some of your
teacher?
Can you tell us some of your experiences from that critical 1980s 1990s transitional period?
From 1984 to 1990. Well.
Okay.
I didn't teach that many white people.
That's for sure.
It was already becoming a non-white country.
I wasn't teaching a lot of white people. I mean, well, what white students? You know? I mean, I taught black classes. I taught Hispanic classes. Go down to the South Bay, and now you're teaching Filipinos and Samoans, I guess, and. I don't know. Where's the white people? There are white people in San Pedro. That's true.
Well, so what were the classes
not sure.
like? What did you teach?
I just taught everything. I was a substitute teacher, so I taught everything under the sun, you know. And towards the end of the decade, they're starting to get it to be a lot of Southeast Asians. I taught it in Santa Ana. I was teaching a lot of Southeast Asians. And I did teach some whites in a few areas. I almost don't like to teach white people, really, to tell you the truth.
Why?
I'm too uptight. And they would always try to get me in trouble, you know. And I don't like that.
Robert, yeah. Didn't you say when you were in Beverly Hills, some girl got you kicked out?
Yeah, she got me in trouble, She baited me into saying something stupid.
Was it something anti-Semitic or something sexist?
She just baited me into. I didn't even say anything. She was just baiting me into making a comment on something, you know. She was just talking to me. She said, well, my parents leave on vacation. They leave me the whole house, and they leave me there with my boyfriend. I have sex with him the whole time. What do you think of that? And I was just going, oh, I don't know. You think I'm a slut or something? And I was just saying, I'm not saying you are. Saying you are. I shouldn't even answer the question, you know. Huh?
Was she hot?
She's cute. She's a little Jewish girl. Beverly Hills is full of Jews and Iranians, and that's about it.
I never noticed. I had never noticed at all, I tell you. It's all lies. Oh, no.
Yeah, it's half Jews and half Iranians, and that's it, man. They're a bunch of Middle Easterners. That's it.
Isn't it funny how there's nobody named Drysdale, Clampett, or Hathaway anywhere in Beverly Hills?
Well, the Iranians are all Shahis. they all love the Shah, you know. So they're like the Iranian rich or something like that. A lot of those Iranian girls are very beautiful, though. I will say that. The Jews are just kind of these nerdy Jewish kids, basically, you know. But they're really smart. Also some Chinese and some Koreans. They're just kind of these nerdy kids, but they're, you know, they're basically good kids. But it's a really bad environment because they were like, it was a teacher strike, you know, and I was a strike breaker. And they were just completely hostile. And they were like, we're for the teachers. We're for the strike. Who are you for? Are you for the teachers? You know, and they were like, you're the strike breaker, blah, blah, blah. And they were just like, we're the enemy, you know. They're just trying to get us in trouble the whole time. So, strikes are hard to work, man. It's really hard to work. Because a lot of the students support the teachers who are out on strike. And then you're coming in and you look like the enemy. And if a class wants to get you in trouble, they can do it. And they will try. They'll try very hard to get you in trouble. They're good at it. It's hard not to get in trouble, too. You have to be smart, really smart.
What is interesting, we were talking about the topic of the 80s, a lot of that whole area, like Rodeo Drive, a lot of, like, the landmarks there were built in the 80s. I know there's, like, this, is that, like, faux European streetscape off of Wilshire and Rodeo?
Well, that's the heart. Wilshire and Rodeo is the heart of the tourist area and the heart of the Iranian zone.
That's where I used to work. I used to work right around.
Going back to sort of the movie theme, when we were first planning on this, we talked about discussing, I was thinking at least about discussing two movies that sort of epitomize the 1980s experience or stereotype, anyhow, of California to me, and those were Earth Girls Must Be Easy and Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Lindsay, are you familiar with either one of those?
Fast Times at Ridgemont High, yeah, I'm familiar with that.
But you don't know Earth Girls Must Be Easy?
No.
I'm basically in the same boat. I've seen Fast Time at Ridgemont High. I haven't seen the other one.
Yeah, I highly recommend to you one of the all-time classics Hollywood or 80s, you know, very soft porn. Very soft porn, as a matter of fact, not barely pornographic at all, but by modern standards. But it's called Earth Girls Must Be Easy, and it's about some apparently well-endowed aliens who appear to be Iranians, really. And they all come and, you know, enjoy life in Southern California. I won't tell any more about that, except that one of the famous scenes at the movie was filmed at a particular car wash somewhere in the valley, which a few years after that movie they wanted to tear down, and there was a major protest and a riot to try to keep them from tearing this car wash down, because it was such a great part of American California heritage is embodied in the movie Earth Girls Must Be Easy.
Yeah, I can't really talk about that, but also that's also the era that the porn industry got started in the San Fernando Valley. I know in the 70s it was mostly in New York and maybe San Francisco, but the 80s is when the porn industry in the valley got started. But that's more of a question for our friend Luke Ford.
In
the 70s, porn was run by the mafia. Did you know that?
Well,
and things
changed out.
Because I used to go watch porno movies. They had theaters back then, and the only way to watch them was to go to the porno theaters. You know? So you go to like Mitchell Brothers. I had to go to Mitchell Brothers theater because that was like a chain. Another one was Pussycat Theaters. That was another chain. Yeah. So, and I used to go watch porn movies back in the 70s. And at the end of the movie, they have all these credits. It's all these Guido and Salvatore, all these Italian, about 100 Italian names. And people were saying, hey, the mafia makes these movies. And apparently, all these movies were like made by the mafia or something. I mean, that was the impression. What are all these Italian names doing at the end, you know? And,
we all know which group dominates the porn industry, and stereotypically people don't think of Italians.
Oh, now it's Jews?
Well, it is a
well,
kind
back,
of organized crime and mafia.
Back then it was mafia for some reason. I don't know, but I mean, now it's Jews,
well, back
right?
then, it started, the porn industry basically got its start in New York, especially like around like 42nd Street and Times Square, but then the 80s it shifted to the Valley.
Right. Well, maybe porn was just almost kind of quasi-illegal in the 70s. I mean, Deep Throat just got legalized in 1973, so... Well, maybe that's why the mob was there, and it was just almost kind of a quasi-illegal thing.
So, Charles, with that, we're going to talk about that film, Fast Time at Ridgemont High. So, you sort
well,
of say that really captures the Valley, San Fernando Valley. It takes well, that film came out like in the very early 80s, but I'm sure that the Valley has obviously changed a lot since then.
No, oh, well, the Valley was an ocean of. You know, basically blondes in the 70s and even in the early 80s. And yeah, Fast Times in Ridgemont High came out in 82, and everybody is, you know, blonde beach bums. I mean, maybe Lindsay was in it. Were you in that movie?
I think so.
So, I mean, the interesting thing, of course, is that the Fast Times that take place at Ridgemont High, they aren't really all that fast by modern standards, and there's still sort of not a bang but a whimper about the loss of innocence. It's related to the same thing we were talking about related to true stories, the transformation. The discomfort of growing it up in a world where you're expected to be fast, but it's not exactly there's no roadmap for how to behave. Would you agree with that, Lindsay?
I suppose. What do you mean you're expected to be fast?
I mean to be cool. You have, you
oh,
know,
yeah.
if being yeah. Stacy, one of the key characters in this, Stacy Hamilton, and I mean she's a 15-year-old sophomore and a virgin, and she's
okay.
worried that she's not attractive enough or experienced enough to meet, you know, let alone have a relationship with a real man, and so she's
is she the blonde
a much
girl?
Older guy. Which blonde
so
girl?
She does what?
She lies about her age and gets involved with an older man.
How old is he?
He's, you know, it's technically statutory rape. He's 26.
Oh, okay.
Technically, it's statutory rape. No one seemed very concerned about it. But the point is that Stacy's whole identity is tied up with an expectation of sex because it's the thing she's supposed to do. And
yeah,
she
I know.
Gets pregnant. And she gets pregnant. And I mean, this is again related to Durkheim's point about anomie, where one set of values is gone, and yet you haven't really formulated a good way of living according to a new set of values. The expectations are very ambiguous, and you know the demands on in the 80s it was a big issue that women girls felt like they were being pressured into sex, and the interesting thing is that by the year 2000 that has totally disappeared. From
really?
Our national consciousness, you know,
really?
It's like, huh?
What do you mean?
I mean, girls are sexually active when they're 12 or 13, and you know, virginity lasting until 15 or 16 appears to be fairly unusual.
But that's not true. I've seen statistics showing that half of 17-year-old high school kids are still virgins or something. I'm not sure where they got that from, but I mean, there's a lot of.
Neither am I. They certainly haven't gotten it from the populations I've been observing.
There's also this other thing going on, you know,
well,
with
Charles,
all the conservative Christians.
Charles,
you know,
how much time do you spend around teenagers these days?
I refuse to answer on the grounds that to do so might tend to incriminate me. No, I didn't say that. One meets them in the ordinary course of life. I hang out in coffee shops and in New Orleans, and you know, there are high school people around, and what can I say? It's a subject of some interest to me.
You just enjoy their beauty from a distance.
Again, I refuse to answer on the grounds that to do so might tend to incriminate me, but you know, I'm not willing to say that I have no interactive conversational basis for my statements, I guess is what I'd say.
Charles, you were telling me an interesting story in a previous show about how back in the 70s, like, your friends would go skinny dipping and smoke pot on the beaches of Malibu. And I think that's really symbolic of that era, maybe more the 70s and the 80s, because on one hand, you had a kind of a culture of, you had a sort of culture of hedonism, but at the same time, it was still a sort of a strongly social trust environment. And I think that is unique to that era, because before that, society was a lot more traditional and maybe a degree of prudishness. But today that wouldn't be possible because we have a very kind of a low-trust society, more of a kind of police state. So I think that experience of basically teenagers swimming naked and smoking pot on the beaches of Malibu is very unique to that era.
I think, well, Malibu is too crowded to do it now. You know, forget it. I mean, you have no privacy in a place that's wall-to-wall condos. Same thing I was saying about Florida, the Gulf Coast of Florida. There's really no nature left to have nature experiences unless you go way up to Idaho or Montana or something.
Well,
I don't know about Northern California. Maybe there are some
places on the Central Coast, but they're just, you can't swim in them.
Too many great white sharks or what?
I suppose. But would you say that's kind of, Robert, you should, well, Robert, you were telling me that you prefer the 70s to the 80s, but Robert, Lindsay, you say that description of that era is accurate, where there's simultaneously a sense of kind of hedonism, but there's also a higher degree of a social trust that we don't have today.
Yeah, there's more hedonism. There was hedonism, but there wasn't all this materialism. '70s was the time when you could actually be a ski bum. You could actually be a surf bum. Yeah, lift tickets were $8. What are they now? 50? You know, see what I mean? You can't. The only people who could ski anymore are rich people. I mean, it wasn't like that back then. There wasn't so much income inequality. It was a kind of a liberal era. I mean, our governor was Governor Moonbeam. You know,
he's still our governor.
Yeah,
governor,
way more conservative. He's a lot more conservative now than he was then. You weren't around back then. I mean, he was really liberal. You know, it was normal to be like a liberal person back then. Because kind of everybody was. It's kind of like the hippie thing that really ended, you know. And you didn't have to have a lot of money.
Also,
you could live for cheap, you know.
Robert, you also said you prefer the early 80s to the late 80s.
Yeah. The early 80s was sort of a continuation of the 1970s, the late 1970s. And as the 80s went on, the more and more the Reaganites type values took over, and the love of money and materialism and greed and just the whole reactionary culture and it being hip to be a conservative and a right winger and a Reaganite and all that stuff. The whole backwards thing, regressive thing. That really took hold later on in the 80s as things got really entrenched. I mean, when he first came in, a lot of people just wanted to kill him, you know. I mean, the country was just completely split. Half the country just wanted to kill him, you know. He totally polarized the figure. But as it went on, it just became more and more hip to be a Reaganite. I mean, I think Reagan left office and all these... Every Democratic senator stood up and said what a great man he was. Ted Kennedy stood up and gave this speech about how wonderful Reagan was. I mean, I was reading a paper. That's sickening, man. That is sickening. I was reading the paper that the next morning. I thought, Jesus Christ. The most liberal guy in the Senate is going on and on about how wonderful Reagan is. And the whole country was treating Reagan like he was some sort of God or something, you know? He had like this 65% approval rating, and you know, I mean,
Lindsay, let me offer you a terribly reactionary perspective on what you're saying. I am probably what most people consider a terribly reactionary person, and you know, I think that Reagan deserved praise from Ted Kennedy because Reagan came in on this overwhelming tsunami of conservative feeling in 1980, and I'm sure that given what you told me, you were not reading the magazine of the John Birch Society, American Opinion, on the newsstands in Harvard Square in November of 1980, but I was, and I'll never forget reading the American Opinion article entitled "What Conservatives Expect of Ronald Reagan," and it was just a full issue long article about everything that had happened under Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Johnson, Nixon, and Carter that conservatives of the John Birch species expected Reagan to do. And would you be surprised if I told you that Reagan never did a single thing on that list? Reagan saved the New Deal, which he promised to dismantle. Reagan saved the Great Society, which he promised to
Charles,
dismantle.
You're talking to Lindsay supports the New Deal, probably.
I gathered that from what he's saying, but I mean, I'm just saying, I'm intrigued by the whole thing because, from my perspective, it makes perfect sense that what Reagan achieved was a new synthesis, if you will, of socialist and conservative socialist thought together with a little bit of conservative rhetoric. Maybe moderately conservative rhetoric, because if Reagan had been who he said he was instead of who he actually was, he would have wiped out half of the government as it existed in 1980. Instead, by the time he left office, he had doubled the size of the government. He had quadrupled the national debt. He had taken deficit spending through credit to levels previously unimagined. He had made the United States a part of the global community that it had never been before by these international trade and immigration compromises. And I think that, you know, Reagan really is a hero of the socialization of the United States. I mean, the reason that it's in some sense true, I agree with Lindsay, that Obama is a Reaganite, because it's thanks to Ronald Reagan that Newsweek magazine in February of 2009, when right after Obama was inaugurated, could truthfully write, a headline that said, "We are all socialists now." It is only thanks to Reagan, Bush, and Bush that that headline was even remotely true. Everyone in the establishment is a socialist now, and so I would submit that the 1980s were the years when basically the conservatives in the United States committed suicide, basically. I mean, you didn't see Barry Goldwater, you know, disemboweling himself publicly or anything, but he quietly stepped off the stage and endorsed gay marriage. I mean, okay, not gay marriage, he endorsed homosexuality in part because his grandson, Ty Ross, who was a friend of mine in summer camp, came out as gay and having AIDS also. And family loyalty is very strong in the Goldwater family, and I respect that.
Lindsay, do you want to comment on that?
Comment on what?
On my agreeing with you that Obama is a Reaganite because Reaganite was a socialist.
I am a socialist, and we don't think any of those people were socialists, and we don't even think Obama is a socialist. And, you know, we don't think Reagan was a socialist. We think all those people were like the opposite of socialists. And, I mean, Obama's an improvement, but all the right-wingers saying he's a socialist. I mean, I don't know one socialist who would agree with that statement. You know what I mean? I mean,
I've got to ask you then, what would you like Obama to do?
National health care. I mean, if it's doable, if he could. I'm not sure if it's doable, though. Well, he needs to start opposing trade deals. How about that, number one? And what kind of socialist pushes through a reactionary trade deal like that? Anti-worker, anti-consumer, anti-environment, totally pro-corporate. You know, it's just a corporate giveaway. Everything, their wish list, everything they want. The bankers and finance capital of the world, I'll tell you, they definitely hate communism. They hate socialism.
They may say they do, but what they're achieving is the concentration of the abolition of private property and the concentration of all real estate in the ownership of government-controlled banks. And I'll respect Robert's themes from this one point on, but if you want to have a debate about this, we can do another topic.
We can do another show. Let's get back to topic. So one thing that that film Fast Time at Ridgemont High talks on, touches upon, is the whole sort of L.A. Mall culture. And also True Stories touches upon the mall culture as well in Texas. But I think L.A. has sort of been the center of the mall culture. I mean, I guess...
And up to a point, mall culture is now dying, which is kind of interesting. Well, it's being transformed, certainly. You know, the character of malls is radically changing, and up to a point, I mean, what I would perceive is that the whole world is turning into malls, and so there's simply no distinction between mall society and the rest of society right now. It's all sort of blurring and losing distinctiveness. What do you think of that, Lindsay? They're losing their distinctiveness because all of society is turning into, American society is turning into one big mall.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I'm not sure if I like that. I mean, maybe I do. Yeah, I kind of like this homogenization of culture thing because that means that I can go anywhere in this country and sort of get along with people and just be a hipster or something like that, you know?
How do you live that? I mean, tell me how do you live out your life as a hipster? That's kind of interesting.
Well, you know, I can meet a woman. I can pick up a woman at a bar or something, or I can pick up I can go meet a woman in another city or something, or meet a guy or something, and we'll be able to go out and have a good time and have fun and go over to their place or something and go out to a club or something, and we'll have enough in common that we'll have a good time. I can go on a date with them, and we'll hit it off, and we'll relate on some sort of a level because there's this monoculture going on, and
every other, most of the people you go out with, most of the guys you make friends with, that you're going to want to share a pretty common culture with them. So it's easy to make friends. I mean, with the hip people, with the hip crowds, with the hip types, yeah. I mean, we're all kind of on the same level, so we can all kind of hang out, you know? It's not like I can't go to Texas because they're all rednecks or something. I can't go to Georgia because they're Confederates. I mean, everybody's just sort of becoming the same. It means we can all sort of hang out, and we can connect, and we can relate, and we can be friends. We can date. We can improve.
I was going to say the Iranians, are, the Dallas has been taken over by Iranians, and Georgia's been taken over by Mexicans, so it may be a little bit different from what you imagine.
The Mexicans still have a very different culture, and I have a pretty difficult time really getting into Mexican culture. I live with these Mexicans all over the place, and I'm just not connecting with them. I don't date Mexican women. I don't hang out with Mexican guys. I don't, you know, I'm just not willing to become a part of their culture. Mexican culture is not my culture. I'm sorry.
My actual impression of Mexicans in general is that some of the more, like, traditional ones are a lot friendlier, but I noticed the trend is, like, a lot of the Mexican-Americans are kind of adopting, like, negative characteristics of, like, ghetto black culture. Have you observed that?
They are. Yeah, they are. They're sort of like turning into ghetto blacks on a somewhat more upgraded version of ghetto blacks. Better yet, white trash.
The people in the anti-illegal immigration movement, they don't want to talk about it. They bash Mexicans from Mexico, but they won't say anything about Mexican Americans. But I mean, I personally, in some ways, prefer Mexicans from Mexico to Mexican Americans.
The real gangbanger types are all born here. They're not illegals. They're not immigrants.
I mean Charles,
born here, the immigrants are good people. Immigrants are almost all good people. Immigrants are wonderful people. They're all hardworking and they're mostly honest. And they're just kind of peasant types from Mexico. They have these really good values. They have these really, really good values, you know. I mean, they're really honest.
But Charles, you've spent extensive time in Mexico. Would you agree with that observation?
I have had extensive experience with Mexicans in the United States too, and it's a very mixed up situation, is what I'd say. I'd say that on the one hand, I agree with Lindsay that most Mexican immigrants have a much greater work ethic than the average Anglo-American, and that's why they're here. That's on average. I don't see how we could possibly deny that. It's absolutely true. But on the other hand, Mexican prison gang culture in the United States, I don't think it's more elevated than black culture at all. As a matter of fact, I'd say exactly the opposite. I find that the black culture in America is much, much more conservative, much, much more value-oriented than the real ghetto Mexican culture. But one thing that you've got to understand is that the people who are coming over to the United States from Mexico are, by and large, the very bottom of the social pyramid in Mexico. They are the people who are the most disenfranchised, most oppressed, and it's all because of the huge overpopulation of Mexico in the past. Well, 35 some odd years is what it comes down to, because Mexico's population in the 1970s was barely 60 million.
Wow.
And a terrible thing happened to Mexico in 1978. It didn't happen in Mexico, but it happened to Mexico. And the terrible thing that happened to Mexico in 1978 was the election of John Paul II as Pope. and he became, as everyone knows, the first pope to travel outside the United travel outside of Italy. The bottom line is I partially agree and partially disagree with Lindsay on this. We had a meeting in Santa Ana the other night about a need to develop Mexican identity, you know, along the lines that identitarian groups in other areas.
Well, the thing is, I want to make a point is people complain about Mexican culture taking over, but my observation is a lot of Mexican Americans, they basically have no culture whatsoever. Like, they go to Walmart, they listen to rap music.
No, that's not
They basically have absolutely nothing. I mean,
I totally agree with you there.
Mexican culture has been retained here. First and second generations are very, very much into being Mexican. They're into being Mexican. Third generation, they're still kind of Mexican. They're still kind of tight family, close family. They marry young. They don't screw around a lot. Kind of conservative values. Women are very feminine. Men are very masculine. They're still kind of Mexican. You know, and second generation still speaks Spanish, and they're really deep. And it's just a whole different culture, really. And it's not that bad in a lot of it. It's kind of a conservative culture. You conservatives would probably like it. It's not like this white culture or this monoculture that we got going where everybody is having sex by the time they're 15. You know, it's not like that at all. I mean, the women have the Madonna whore syndrome, and they're practically expected to be virgins when they're married. Well, I don't know if it's quite that, but, you know.
Yeah, I think you've been living in rural or small-town California. L.A. and Dallas are not that way.
Well, this is
a
city of 50,000. It's just kind of traditional Mexican. It's kind of traditional Mexico. So, you know, traditional Mexican values still hold sway here in this place. By third generation, it starts breaking down to a certain extent.
Back to the topic of Southern California. So we were talking about mall culture, and this is not so much, but one thing I tried to know, when I grew up in Westwood, and there was this local mall called Westside Pavilion, and I do remember sort of the demographic transformation there, because when I was a kid, it was mostly... Oh, Charles, you were telling me you used to go there. You used to have very 1980s kind of a faux Parisian theme to it.
Well, it's really decayed a lot since then. It was a very popular mall in the 86 to 89 time range.
Well, I remember it more from the 90s, but it still retained that kind of 80s feel, but it was more upscale back then, and it was also mostly white, but there were still a significant number of Iranians. But they've sort of, today it's become sort of very much, if you go there today, basically you just see, like, it's Mexican, Middle Eastern, and Asian. It's basically all immigrants.
Is this the Mall of America?
No. He's talking about Westwood. It's right on Westwood, and Olympic Pico, basically.
Oh, why are there so many Mexicans in Westwood? I mean, it's an upscale town.
Borderline. It's not all that upscale anymore. The Iranians took care of that. The highest class Iranians are in Beverly Hills, and not so high class Iranians are all in Westwood.
What are all those Mexicans doing in Westwood, Robert?
Well, they don't live
there.
They go there for their...
Yeah.
And the other trend I've been noticing is Charles was complaining about how single family homes in L.A. are being torn down and replaced by big condos. But one trend I've seen in L.A. is that a lot of the strip malls from the 70s and 80s are being replaced by, basically five-story condos with, shops on the ground level.
That's what I'm saying about the mall culture disappearing and becoming almost indistinguishable from society as a whole. Yeah, I mean, that's just mind-boggling. And that's, I don't know, Lindsay, what's your feeling about Agenda 21?
What is it?
Oh, my
basically,
God.
Basically, Charles's concept is that the densification of cities is a bad thing.
Oh, you mean we're thinking it's so expensive and all that?
It's a pattern of population concentration where cities are basically going to be continuous, high density, replacing the multi-family dwellings, replacing single family homes everywhere. And,
what is the alternative? Basically, we have three options. We can continue building over wilderness, which is absolutely horrific. We can eject the invaders, which is probably not going to happen. That basically leaves us with the only option is to build basically like high rises within existing urban areas. So
I believe that. Have you read Kunstler? Any of you guys read James Kunstler?
Oh yes.
Arthur Kunstler.
Kunstler. Yeah. Well, anyway, he has said that this whole suburbia culture thing is unsustainable and it's all going out. He said we can't sustain it anymore. We can't have all these people living 50, 100, 150 miles away from cities and driving in and out of the cities every day. And he said that when this housing crash came, a lot of these suburbs just got nuked. They got completely wiped out, you know. Like half the houses went into foreclosure. And he talks about these upscale suburbs that are almost like abandoned towns where like half the homes are abandoned, you know. And there's all these kids kind of running around smoking dope and stuff. And it's just the whole place
interesting,
is just kind of
interesting, how none, interesting how none of this actually leads to a diminution in of housing values or housing prices. It's almost as if the banks were, trying to control prices or something.
The housing prices did crash here in California, didn't they? Yeah, they did, yeah.
Robert, you were making a point on a previous show is if you were saying you don't see, like, denser communities as inherently bad. Like, you gave the example to like cities in Europe, like in places like Italy.
Yeah. Well, we're just going to turn into Europe. We're just going to become more and more like Europe, and I actually think that's a good thing.
I mean, my view on this is I'm not against dense communities as long as they're well planned out, as long as you have like a high quality of architecture and a high culture. But I think the combination of density and like a low quality of culture and low quality of architecture is what makes a miserable place. But I think density can work in some situations. I don't see it as inherently bad. But Charles is probably going to disagree with me.
Well, I mean, it's basically a discussion of autonomy versus dependency. I mean, what concerns me most is the degree to which people are becoming helpless, and suburban life is indeed unsustainable when it's based strictly on a cash economy. But if we were to transform the suburban lawns into gardens and see people achieving more in the way of even partial self-reliance as food producers, I think that we'd have a very different experience of what suburban life is like.
Do you think Kunstler's right that this thing of these suburbs just extending out endlessly further and further away to where people are maybe 50 or 100 miles away from the city and they're driving in 2 or 3 hours each way commuting? He says that's insane and it's going out and it's unsustainable.
Well, I mean, it certainly hasn't. It shows no sign of going out if you drive along the highways of California or Texas right now. People still maintain extremely exurban
lifestyles. And like I said, I think the problem is not so much the low-density suburban population as the use of land.
Do you think 50 to 100-mile commutes, 2 or 3 hours each way, is sane?
I'm not sure that the economy that creates them is sane.
That's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's not sustainable.
The cash
and credit economy.
With what's going on in LA, LA has been sort of, we touched on this on our last show, but what is going on in LA is LA is getting a lot denser, and they are trying. LA's traditionally been very suburban and car oriented, but the plans by a lot of the political leaders are to turn LA more into a city like New York, where people live in like high rises and commute by subway. Robert and Charles, what are your thoughts on that?
Probably not a bad idea.
You know, my ideals are just that we need to encourage people to become more and more self-sufficient rather than less and less. And suburbs built on trains are not that much better, in my mind, than suburbs and cash and credit dependency built on cars. They may be more sustainable. They may be more ecologically and economically sustainable, but they're not better. They're worse. It's all the same kind of. The problem, in my view, is the cash and credit cash and credit based life. We need to go back to a more substantive, self reliant, productive economy.
So there was a movie called Blade Runner, and it came out in the early 1980s. But what is fascinating about that movie is it takes place in L.A. in the year 2019, which is in the very near future. Robert and Charles, have you seen that film?
I've seen it.
I have not. But I'm a very great fan of folks, a lot of apocalyptic movies.
So I guess it kind of depicts it's sort of a dystopian science fiction film. Just to give kind of an overall summary, I'm not going to get into the plot too much, but it does depict LA. It does interesting about the film. Is it one thing about it? It depicts sort of a very heavily populated California that is extremely crowded. There's a lot of pollution. You have the main characters, and they're called replicants. They're basically like robots, but they look like humans. But what's fascinating is most of the main characters are white, and then you have the people in the background who make up the majority, who are overwhelmingly like non-white, and they're sort of just in the background. They don't really play a major role. They're just sort of the backdrop. But the replicants, they sort of serve as both. They serve as like warriors, but they also serve as like prostitutes.
Yeah.
And the other thing about the film is it depicts sort of the Japanese as being culturally dominant, because at the time Japan was rising as a major economic power.
Is that what all the Oriental writing on all the walls is? I thought that was Chinese writing.
No, it's Japanese. I think a lot of it was filmed actually in Tokyo. So it definitely has that. Yeah.
Was that before anime had become sort of a dominant sub theme of American culture?
That was in the middle of punk rock, and punk rock was an outgrowth of anime, if anything was, you know.
Punk rock was an outgrowth of anime?
Well, of course. It's the ultimate expression of nihilism, you know.
And
what do you call a completely nihilistic movement? I mean, it's going to come from some sort of environment of anime or something like that, right? I mean,
Robert, how accurate do you think the film is of basically like Southern California today?
In some ways, it does look like downtown L.A. Downtown L.A., that's sort of like that. But you know something else? Well, first of all, that is from a short story by Philip K. Dick. Have you heard of him? Fiction writer?
Isn't he the same one who wrote the basis, the story that was the basis for the Man in the High Castle?
Yeah, The Man in the High Castle is one of his novels, actually. Well, anyway, Blade Runner is based on a Philip K. Dick short story, a famous one that's called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? But Philip K. Dick fans say that the movie doesn't even really resemble the story at all. And the story's really good, supposedly. And they say that the movie just completely basically mangled the story, and they're not very happy with the movie as far as an adaptation of that story goes. But I would like to say I was in the Bay Area just last weekend, and I was driving through there, through San Francisco and through the peninsula just south of San Francisco, and it was turning into nighttime, and all these billboards were up. And all of a sudden, I thought I was in the future. And I was with this guy. He's got all these latest gadgets. You know, on this trip, he had all these like little gadgets and stuff. He'd just like press some button and like something really weird would happen. And I'm like, I'm not even familiar with all this. I'm like, what? You did it like that? What? We went to a hotel and they give you a key that, you know, you can just steal the key because if you leave or something. I mean, just weird stuff like that. All over the place. And then going through San Francisco, it was all lit up and it was turning dark, and there are all these billboards everywhere, and it was all just internet and the future and modernism and these gadgets and these devices and stuff. And it's like, that's the future. That's the future right there. That's the future.
We actually do have, like, in L.A., there's a lot of, like, electronic billboards in L.A., but the ones in L.A. are kind of bland. At least the stuff in Blade Runner is pretty cool. But
right.
Actually, a lot of the type of signage in Blade Runner, it's more – a lot of it kind of reminds me more of, like, the older signs that used to be more popular back in the, like, 70s and 80s, opposed to the newer stuff.
Yeah, that's true.
Actually,
that's true. Yeah, those older neon signs are not seen all that much anymore.
I think they're really cool. But, I mean, I think it'd be cool if they kept a lot of them, but they replaced them because they're not energy efficient.
Oh, really? Okay, all right. Well, Vegas is the original neon city, you know, right?
Yeah.
Right, Charles?
I don't understand quite what you're talking about. Neon signs and what kind of different variations?
I said Las Vegas is the original neon city, right, Charles?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No doubt about that.
Neon Wonderland.
But I think definitely, like, the older ones, like, the best, the coolest ones are, like, a lot of the older stuff from, like, the 50s and 60s and even the 80s. But the newer stuff, it's not, some of the newer stuff is cool, too, but it's not the same.
You mean the older stuff was not energy efficient, so they had to junk it?
The older stuff was a lot cooler, but as I said, they're taking a lot of it down because it's not energy efficient.
And then they got this new stuff up that doesn't look as good.
No, not as much.
It's basically a downgrade. The upgrade is a downgrade. Yeah, I'm seeing that so many times now. That should be the theme of modernism, you know? The upgrade is a downgrade.
Oh, I totally agree with you there, and that's been true for years, my whole life.
And it's especially
absolutely.
In products, you know, I mean, I have products that I purchased in the 1970s, and they were really good, and they, like, last forever, for, like, years or decades, like a microwave, and now you buy a microwave, and it breaks in, like, 6 months or a year, and it's crap, you know, and it's really expensive, and it's just, it's like they're just building more and more junk, really expensive junk, the breaks after about a year, and it didn't used to be that way. You could buy a fairly good just about anything in America, and it lasts a really long time. But now they're all made in China, and they break. And everything I buy, like a lamp or something, it breaks in about a year or so, and it's junky.
Maybe they intentionally design it to break so you'll buy a new one.
It's planned obsolescence. Yeah. That's the system called capitalism. See, that's one thing I hate about capitalism. All you capitalist fanboys, you're cheering for that.
okay, one of the things about capitalism is, like, I'll give you an example, is, like, the 1920s was considered a very sort of a hyper-capitalistic era, but they still created, like, a lot of great architecture, and there were still, like, high products of values. So capitalism is part of it, but just overall, the, like, decline of stuff has been, the decline of products, you sort of seen a decline in the quality of products. Everything
you see, I would say that it's not capitalism at all. It's the credit system that and the credit-based economy that made everything so very cheap. Because Model T Fords, if they had been maintained, basically were designed to last forever, and so were almost through the 1950s and early 60s. You had cars made out of everything was metal inside of them, even the dashboard and high quality glass, and everything now is plastic. And part of the advantage is that metal, basically, because it can be melted down or soldered, it's the most recyclable substance in the world. Metal and glass are. You can recycle these things almost infinite number of times, and so you can fix a broken metal car much easier than you can fix a broken plastic car. But in a credit economy, you need constant new things to be sold to keep the hyper activity going, which is essential for a credit economy. And so, the point I keep making is that capitalism is really about things of true value. Capital is things of true value. And what's happened is that nobody wants capital anymore because, in essence, capital is too stodgy. Capital is too stable. And so everybody wants this highly, volatile credit-based economy that's basically as durable as plastic and as completely unrecyclable and unreusable and unfixable as plastic. You can't fix plastic when it's broken, and you just have to replace it. And so the plastic and the credit go together.
Do you think finance capital is even capitalism? I mean, they don't even make a product, I mean, capitalism
exactly.
Is to make a widget, I mean, that's like a gambling casino. How is that capitalism? I mean,
No, very, very, very true. What gambling is so interesting. I mean, I was just staying a couple of days last week at Harrah's in the Rincon Reservation down by Escondido in northern San Diego County. And, it was amazing. These people who are addicted to gambling, and they go into this very posh hotel and they spend all day in front of one-armed bandits, basically pouring their life savings away and into nothing. And again, it's all about making people dependent and, making sure that if people are were responsible enough to build up savings for retirement, you destabilize as many of them as possible by getting them into gambling basically wiping them out.
Charles, did you get a chance to sort of look up the film? Like, do you agree? How accurate do you think that film is based on what Robert and I said about how things are today?
It sounds like it was very, very prescient, very accurate. I really needed to study it more. I mean, all these prophecies, I think one interesting thing about all these prophecies is you can see the roots of the prophecy in modern times. I mean, I don't know if you've seen it on Facebook, the repeated comment that people are circulating around. 1984, Orwell's 1984, was supposed to be a warning, not a how-to manual. But it feels very much as if the current government somehow got hold of 1984, and they're using it as a step-by-step instruction manual for how to govern the world. And
Robert, I think that Blade Runner is excessively dystopian. The vision of the future in Blade Runner is excessively dystopian. And L.A. is not dystopian like Blade Runner right now. It's not that bad. I mean, capitalism hasn't declined that far yet. I mean, that city sort of
the film is, it is sort of a nightmarish vision, but at the same time,
yeah,
from a cinematography perspective, there is something kind of beautiful about the film at the same time.
It's all these great big skyscrapers, but they sort of seem like they're falling apart. And it's raining all the time, and it's like raining pollution. And it seems like there's all these kind of
like
poor people.
Predicting, well, yeah, like the rain was sort of predicting like global warming.
And there's a lot of poor people. There's like all these masses of sort of poor people.
What it's depicting is that there was this previous era of extreme sort of a prosperity and economic growth, but after that there's been sort of a decline, so you have sort of the remnant of that, and that's sort of the setup
of
the film.
Things haven't gotten that bad yet since 2008. Although capitalism is definitely in a crisis.
One thing, we were talking about earlier in this show, in our last show, we were talking about the 1980s, and we talked about music and the Talking Heads. Robert, you were in sort of into the really, like, you were into the punk scene back then. What are your thoughts on the different genres in the 80s? In the 80s, there was the two big ones. Well, there was punk, and there was also a new wave.
Well, they were all kind of the same thing at first. You know, new wave and punk was all just the same stuff, sort of. And Talking Heads was considered to be a punk band. I saw them in 1979 at UCLA. They're really good. They're sort of art punk band, sort of,
One thing that is interesting about, like, music, if you look, so the 70s, you had a very strong sort of a 70s culture was very heavily black influenced, and then also 90s culture, hip-hop became mainstream, and that was also black influence. One thing about the 80s is that the pop culture became sort of, in a lot of ways it was kind of super white, but there was also a strong British influence in the, like most of the, a lot of the top music came out of England.
Yeah, and metal really changed and turned into its own genre, heavy metal, the hair metal guys and all that stuff. I mean, Motley Crue and all those are kind of the new metal bands. The old metal bands, they didn't really call it metal. That was like Deep Purple and Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin and all that. But people just called that rock and roll. They didn't really call it metal. Metal really came into its own. And then a neo-glam scene started, you know, based on sort of imitating the glam rock of the 1970s, the New York Dolls and Bowie and T-Rex and et cetera. Basically, punk just started branching out into all these different branches. Just turned into this tree, and all these branches started taking off. And punk this, punk that, and you know, all these different types of punk branching all over the place.
Charles, what are your thoughts on the music from that era?
Very few, very limited. I can't extensively comment on the music at all. Not my department. Well, you don't seem to understand. I spent a lot of those years in Mexico and other parts of South America, and my life was kind of unusual. I probably went to more Bayreuth festivals than the rock concerts in the course of my life. You know.
So you and Robert Lindsay, you've had some very different life experiences.
I think that's safe to say.
You came from sort of opposite walks of lives, but ironically, you've come to some of the same conclusions.
I'm sort of more of a faddist, I guess. I guess I'm kind of more of a faddist than Charles, you know. I was a hippie when it was cool to be a hippie. Then I was a punk when it was cool to be a punk. And then I got into the goth scene. You know, just...
I've never been up to date with modern culture in my entire life.
I wore all the clothes. Really, I was just getting into to get laid, though, just to get. Also, it was an expression of my the way I felt. I was really angry at the time. I was angry at men, and punk rock was a good album for that, frankly. The goth scene, though, I just got into that to get late women. That's the only reason I got into that.
Well, it's very interesting, and what can I say? It's just, you know, comparing notes is very interesting on these guns. But, I mean, I'm just curious, what do you think are the differences between all the different dystopian movies that there are? I mean, since I haven't seen Blade Runner, can you sort of tell me what you'd say the difference is between Blade Runner and the feel of, say, V for Vendetta or The Hunger Games?
How about Road Warrior, Mad Max, you know?
Okay.
Hunger Games, I'll talk about some different films. Well, there's three different films I want to compare. One of them, Blade Runner depicts sort of a dystopia. Hunger Games is also a dystopian film, but it's very sort of segregated, where they sort of depict a decadent elite that lives in a city that's cut off. And I think Charles and I were kind of joking that those people were the descendants of the people we see walking on the Third Street Promenade. But then you also have the main character, Katniss. She's from a working class background in it's either the Ozarks or the Appalachians.
Appalachians. Clearly Appalachians.
Yeah.
Northern Alabama, Western.
In Hunger Games is a very segregated society between the different groups. And where the elite are, it's interesting. Like, most of them are depicted as white, but they have, like, a sort of a handful of sort of a token non-white and, like, mixed-race people sort of around, like, basically as tokens. There's another film that I haven't seen, but I've read about. It's called Her. And it also takes place in L.A. in the future. But it depicts sort of L.A. as a eco-friendly utopia where everyone is like a hipster. So it's a very different film than Blade Runner.
How about in terms of the politics of these places, though? Let's put it this way. Can you think of a single dystopian or in a single futuristic movie that has any traces of democracy or a Republican form of government in it?
Another one is a Clockwork Orange, which also depicts a dystopian society. They all depict pretty much like authoritarian societies, or they depict like anarchy, as in the case of Mad Max. But none of them
depict
a functional society with maybe a few exceptions.
What about The Road? Have any of you seen The Road?
No, I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, that's a real dystopian movie.
We are basically out of time, so I would like to thank Charles Lincoln and Robert Lindsay for being on the show.
Well, it's great talking to you, Robert, and great talking to you, Robert Lindsay, and let's get back together and discuss some of these other movies sometime.
Nice talking to you, Charles.